You're listening to a recording from the Open Society Institute, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at soros.org.
Thank you very much for coming. My name's Heather Doyle, and I'm the director of the Sexual Health and Rights Project here, which is part of the public health program. And I have the honor to introduce to you today Noy Thrupkow, who is a fellow here and started in January as a year-long fellow with the fellowship program. And Noy is a journalist by training, and she comes from a senior correspondent previously with American Prospect. She's published articles in The Nation, in The Guardian, in Marie Claire. And she, it's right before I came, I was actually reviewing the proposal that she had sent, and I think some of the things that stood out to me about why she's an OSI fellow, some of the things about, she had phrases in there about dismantling myths, about amplifying voices of the most marginalized, about accountability, and really also coupling all of those themes with in-depth research and advocacy. And so really, she's a great fit for OSI in terms of a fellowship. Some of the things that she'll be speaking to us today about is it's actually the 10th anniversary this year of the TVPA, which is the Trafficking Victims Protection Act, which was passed by the U.S. government to combat trafficking in persons, and then they also add a phrase, especially into the sex trade, sex slavery, and involuntary servitude. And so Noy is going to touch on what that means exactly and why this is an OSI issue. And she's going to talk about it from the context of an American context as well as Southeast Asia, which is where a lot of Noy's work has taken place. And I think you'll see it brings up a lot of issues around that OSI works on more broadly in other projects, including due process issues, how a piece of legislation or a policy that's about trafficking can actually be a subterfuge for much larger state interests. So how does trafficking have anything to do with immigration policy? How does trafficking have to do with state regulation around policing tactics? You know, those kinds of issues. And how does it, in the end, how does it impact on the marginalized populations that we're working with, including sex workers and migrants? And so with that, I'm going to turn it over to Noy. And what we'll do is we'll have about 15, 20 minutes of Noy speaking, and then we'll open it up to questions and answers. And we have a little over an hour for the session. Thank you. Noy?
Thank you so much, Heather. It's great to be speaking to you all. I think I'm mic'd adequately. I guess I'm going to just begin by telling you about how I got into doing this work, which I think mirrors the trajectory of interest of many people who become interested in this topic. I first learned what I would be doing for 2 years of my life in about 2006, when a friend of mine told me about an evangelical organization that works undercover in brothels in Southeast Asia and South Asia, and they identify underage people in trafficking.
Sorry? You're saying that your microphone is not...
Should I?
Sorry,
no problem. This evangelical group works undercover to identify victims of trafficking, meaning people in prostitution who are underage or people who are there not of their own volition. And then they give this information to the country's police forces, which then conducts an intervention or raid in which everyone is removed from the brothel, everyone, including, customers and clients, along with management, and also anyone working in that establishment. And then what happens after that is sometimes a bit of a murky story. People who are not identified as trafficking victims who have entered the country illegally are deported, and those who are identified as trafficking victims are then put in shelters, from which repeatedly people have run away from these shelters out of economic reasons or other reasons that were to become clear to me as I started to work on this project. But as I started to work on this story, I began to notice that there was a very specific way that both people who did intervention-style work and people who reported on this work began to talk about it, which is they were very interested in the language of rape and raid and rescue and of being bought and being betrayed. So it was very, I guess what I would say, plot-oriented. And reporters would focus on delivering an alien experience that their readers would never forget, and provide plenty of salacious details about being changed of the bed or virginity selling in order to kind of make up what a friend of mine in counter trafficking calls redemptive Victorian pornography, in which the salacious details would be titillating enough and also horrifying enough for the reader to feel justified in condemning this barbaric practice that seems to take place all over Southeast Asia. The problem with this, of course, is that journalists are not exceptionally good at math, and so we did not really ask the questions about what it meant to do longitudinal or evidence-based work on trafficking. And so we began to recycle numbers that were, it turns out to be quite probable that they are highly inflated. And the problem is with that, as you can say, is this really important to know the scope of the problem? And yes, it is somewhat important, because if you don't have a sense of the scope of the problem, you don't really know if all the things that you're doing to try and combat this problem are actually having any kind of real effect. Another thing I began to notice is that people were not really interested in what I call life after a happily ever after. So what happens after a rescue situation? A lot of these people would actually kind of disappear. Some of them in Thailand, for example, victims of trafficking are not granted temporary work permits or residence permits. So essentially they're confined to a shelter, one of which is located on the island. So basically you're stuck on an island and you can't leave until that government, the Thai government, locates your family in Burma, and then you are directly repatriated to that family. So it became clearer to me why people would actually start to run away from a rescue situation. A lot of people didn't conceive of themselves as purely an individual to be saved. They understood themselves as a family member who was trying to support their family or to pay off a debt. And I would argue, I think, as anyone else here would, that if you enter into a situation of debt bondage, that you should not actually be forced to pay off that debt, but that is not something that the people in the situation necessarily feel free of. Because, frankly, traffickers have a significant pull in home villages and can threaten those families. So I started to kind of really become interested in this when I felt like there was a curious emptiness at the heart of this debate, and that emptiness was basically what victims of trafficking themselves were saying about their situation and how they would want to shape policy that was meant to help them. And there was a lot of fear, I think, about the notions of borders and margins, which is not only what happens when people cross from one country to another, but the kind of complication that can ensue when people's bodies are mixed up together, or when trafficked people can net our shrimp or make our clothes or pick our tomatoes, when the very substance of our lives is potentially the product of modern-day slavery, people tend to call it. I call it forced labor. The victims of trafficking were always talked about in specifically that way, that they were victims, that they were voiceless, that they were vectors for vice or disease. And sometimes they were even thought of as disembodied or broken vessels or holes to be made whole. And I think one example of this is what has happened in Cambodia. I mean, first of all, to clarify, and I apologize for only clarifying this now, trafficking under the UN Palermo Protocol is basically the receipt, harboring, transportation of people under the threat of force or of force in order to benefit from their exploitation. So that includes labor, and it includes also work in the commercial sex industry. Under the Bush administration, this became a highly fraught and charged debate whether trafficking was primarily sex trafficking or whether it included labor or to what degree prostitution was also an element that promoted prostitution. And under the Bush administration, the Trafficking Victims Protection Act was kind of expanded to argue that those receiving funding for HIV prevention or anti-trafficking work could not promote the practice of prostitution whatsoever. And that has a very interesting effect, in which organizations that worked with organized sex workers were either forced out of funding or felt they could not accept funding to work on counter-trafficking or HIV because they would have had to cut their ties or their connections with organized sex workers. After that point, then Bush opened up a good degree of federal funding to people working in evangelical organizations and in feminist organizations that had a strongly anti-prostitution stance. So this really starts to skew the debate on trafficking to mean something else. And that confusion was actually played out in Cambodia when in May of 2000 and, oh goodness, when was that? 2008. A series of sweeps began to happen in the capital specifically. There was a new law on a new law on trafficking that was promulgated in February. That new law, however, was written by UNICEF, by a Japanese consultant, and then translated into Khmer. So there was a good deal of confusion about what this actual law meant in the Cambodian context, and there was an article or two about solicitation in there, which when you start to put that in a trafficking law, then you will wind up with some problems. So shortly after the promulgation of that law, district and local level police began to conduct low-level brothel raids under the guise of counter-trafficking actions. And this soon expanded to include public areas like parks and gardens and the streets. And so people started getting rounded up who were sex workers, but also homeless people, intravenous drug users, and other categories of people that were considered undesirable. And these people were put into two government detention centers, one called Brespo, another one called Gokga. And as people started to escape from these centers and inform human rights groups of what was happening, it became clear that this was not any kind of reintegration or rehabilitation or vocational training center as was being talked about. This was a place where people were being forced to work and were also being beaten to death, and there were a number of suicides that also happened there. So a human rights group went in and took some pictures and created a campaign with this information, along with organizing with sex workers organizations as well. And so what this demonstrates is, for me, the kind of confusion around prostitution and trafficking, and basically the way in which the counter-trafficking campaign was used as a fig leaf to basically continuing to conduct business as usual and to even escalate that. And when I mean business as usual, I mean the findings of a 2006 USAID report, which is one of the largest reports ever done on state violence and sex work, which was conducted in Cambodia. And it found about a third of freelance sex workers had been raped by a policeman in the past year, and a third had been gang raped by police. And as for sex workers who worked in brothels and also accepted clients outside, about 57% had been raped by a policeman. And nearly 50% had been gang raped by law enforcement. And 50% of freelancers and 75% of the brothel group had also been beaten by the police in the past year. So this was a group of people who had faced significant abuse by people who were now being funded to oversee their protection. And by this I mean the U.S. government, as part of its counter-trafficking work, had decided to fund the training of law enforcement in Cambodia to the tune of multi-million dollar grants. And so there is a problem that can occur when the police do not police themselves, and when there is a lack of opportunity for civil society organizations or human rights organizations and activists to have access equally to the law. There are no ombudsmen or city civilian commissions or any of the kind of safeguards that one would hope could be in effect in order to help police themselves. So when it got out that these sweeps were happening, the general in charge of the anti-trafficking police said this about the situation. He said, "It is not true police are using this law to arrest and extort money from the suspects. We never arrest prostitutes, but rather we save them from brothels." And mind you, there are 3 deaths and 5 suicides in that time. So I think something was not quite going right. So I guess even in less severe cases, there would be shelter programs that had no clear understanding of the definition of trafficking. So people would be rounded up in these sweeps, and they would be identified as trafficking victims, even though they did not at all fit the definition of being coerced. And what began to happen is after these shelters were brought to light, they were closed down, although they are still kind of operational in an underground sense. And what happened was NGOs began to receive the people who were rounded up in street sweeps. So here we see basically the problem of the co-optation of NGOs to fulfill unstated state mandate, which is to clean up the streets. And this is a very, very difficult situation for the NGOs to be in, frankly, because they are reliant in some degree on the sweeps to find clients. But that means, I think, that they should be doing their work in a slightly different way. But it also means that the NGOs lose their ability to push back and to say, there's something wrong with the way these sweeps are being conducted. These are not real trafficking victims. These are people who want to be in the work that they're doing. And so you lose the power of what could be kind of key civil society actors when they are forced to take in the people who do not want to be taken in. At times, shelters I found in Cambodia would extend their mandate. They would say that they were shelters for the protection of children, but their definition of child went all the way up to the age of 25. Or they would say that they had removed on their intake form, they used to have voluntarily entered the sex industry, and that would be removed. And now it would say exploited by the sex industry, which could be interpreted, one, perhaps as a generous recognition of the abuses suffered by people in the sex industry, or it can be used as a way, as I was saying before, of eliminating the agency and volition of people who choose to do this work. And choice is a very complicated notion, but there are degrees of volition that are being ignored by saying that someone is purely exploited by being in the sex industry. So this was kind of a very difficult story to work on, and I was hoping that as I began to learn about things in the domestic context, that I would find a rosier picture. And indeed, there are degrees of severity, and the situation in the States is significantly better. But what we do see here are themes that I began to see in Cambodia, also reflected here, but in a less severe degree. There has been a shift in emphasis in the Obama administration from the kind of myopic focus on sexual trafficking to also looking at labor trafficking. Because frankly, the majority of trafficking, as far as anyone can tell, is for the purposes of forced labor. And so what has happened, unfortunately, is there is an emphasis on regulations. There are fewer counter-trafficking raids, which can actually be very effective if they're done with sufficient undercover investigation, and they're done in a way to minimize the impact of all the different actors. If you can do stings, that's actually more helpful than doing a full-scale raid. There are tactics to do this that are more responsible, I feel. But instead of that, we now have an emphasis on worksite enforcement and the policing of immigration status through the Secure Communities Program. I'm not sure how familiar you all are with this, but it's an extension of a provision called 287G, in which local and state law enforcement are basically deputized to serve as immigration police. So anyone picked up for a minor offense, and if it's found out that they're foreign-born, their biometrics are run through a database at the Department of Homeland Security and also the FBI, among other databases. And so people who commit second-tier offenses, like even traffic offenses, can be deported. And so what's happening with this is that there's a lot of deportation happening. And the Immigration and Customs folks who also work on trafficking are spending a lot of time deporting people. There are cases like a case in Iowa, a meatpacking case, in which there were genuinely hundreds of victims of trafficking, according to social service providers I've been talking to. They were chained, they were underage, and they were forced to work. And their workplace was raided on worksite violation codes. And these people were arrested for document fraud and deported. These are the people that the Trafficking Victims Protection Act is supposed to protect and to offer visas for their cooperation in criminal cases. They were deported. And this is evidently not uncommon here. There's also many incidences of corruption here. A judge in Buffalo was running a brothel. A cop in Koreatown was busted for working in a trafficking ring. And there are also problems with H-2 visas, in which your status here is contingent upon your being employed by one employer. You can't change that employer. And so when that person controls your housing and your transportation and your work, it should not be a surprise that coercive work situations can arise from that situation. So it's very interesting to try and write about these issues, because trafficking, especially sex trafficking, kind of brings out either a punitive or a protective kind of reaction in all of us. And there's something else that's often going on, and that is, of course, the stories of the victims, because these are not people who are easily duped or just like sheep. These are people who are rather daring, actually, in trying to leave home and trying to provide economic sustenance for their families. And yet, at the same time, it seems that we're intent on rescuing them, but then they face deportation, or they have a very limited statute of expiration for their benefits. And their continuing to stay here is entirely dependent on their cooperation in criminal cases, which means that they're sometimes forced to wear wiretaps and to collect evidence against their traffickers. And there seems to be a little bit something wrong with that. So it's been very interesting to discover a lot of those problems that are occurring here as well. It's also interesting to me the way in which people working on counter-trafficking and law enforcement often see that working on issues of root causes is a dilution of their limited time, efforts, or budget. And for me, that's a kind of cynicism that masquerades as a real-world pragmatism. It's not so terribly difficult to partner with organizations like this great organization I have just been learning about more, the Coalition of Immokalee Workers, which is a human rights-based organization that works with migrant workers and does trafficking work as well, and has launched some extremely successful corporate food campaigns in order to guarantee that corporations will scrutinize every single element of their food supply chain to make sure that tomatoes at Trader Joe's, for example, are not picked by slave labor. And it's not necessarily, you know, the goal of counter-trafficking work to eliminate poverty, but we do really need to be aware of the effects it can have on the lives of those who are trafficked and those that we attempt to reintegrate. And it's important to offer them truly viable economic alternatives and skills-building training that has market relevance. So, you know, you can, in a shelter in Cambodia, you can be a makeup artist or a hairdresser or, you know, a seamstress, or you can get training in garment factory work. But in a garment factory situation, those are closing down rapidly in Cambodia. You have to pay a significant bribe to even get that job. And if you work full-time, you have $45 a month. If you work overtime, that means 7 days a week, up to 12 hours a day, you get $90. So this is not really a truly viable alternative for people. You know, the more I began to work on this, the more I began to feel that the victims themselves, who are very rarely heard from, were empty ciphers in a way that they were used to validate the existence of a just and loving God, or to validate the righteousness of the law. And so they were used to be witnesses to our good deeds or witnesses in a case. But who is paying witness to their lives? Why hasn't anyone written about the process of reintegration and what it means to try and get your T visa and what it means to stand in line and try and get vocational training that will actually work for you and your family? And that's, again, because we're enormously plot-driven. We don't really care about that 95% of anyone's life that is about family and work and all these undramatic things that have nothing to do with being beaten or betrayed or raped. So one thing that I guess I would like to leave you with is, I opened by talking about what it means to write these stories. And I talked to a woman who was, her entry into sex work was one, a situation of trafficking. And she said to me, I met her in this park by the Independence Monument in Cambodia. It was kind of a very interesting tableau. It was the Independence Monument, which was built after, Cambodia became free of the French, and then there was to the right of it Hun Sen's house, and he is the prime minister of the country. And he's been in power since the fall of the Khmer Rouge, which is quite some time ago. And anyone who's been in power that long usually has a complicated relationship with the electorate, let's just say. And so he had a massive house there, and then there was this enormous monument to independence, and I met this woman there. Because the park is basically the working grounds for freelance sex workers. And these are quite young people sometimes and not young at other times. And this one woman, she was about 23, she said to me, "I don't believe anyone else can save me. The staff at this shelter asked me, what can we do to get you to stop what you do? They can't give me money to feed my mother or my children, and their training won't support us. I don't want to leave my family without resources while I get training. And in the end, I think no one can save me but myself." And I found what she said to be incredibly proud and incredibly sad and also more than a bit true. And so when I think of writing the stories like this, I wonder what it would be like to see stories in which people who have faced these situations feel that they can write and assign the central metaphors of their life. Is it going to be that of rescue and victimhood? Or is it going to be that of resilience and writing one's own script and being the rescuer of one's own life? Thank you.
Great, so we're going to open it up to questions, but I'm going to take the prerogative, just ask a couple of questions to start off. And when you started speaking, you made a distinction. You said, "I'm what people call modern-day slavery," but you said what I'm going to call forced labor. Can you talk about that distinction and why you felt it important to make that distinction?
Absolutely. I mean, this is something I'm still wrestling with, actually, because people call trafficking modern-day slavery. And for me, wow, that's a really good question. Slavery is no longer legal anywhere. This doesn't mean that it still doesn't happen, but it is a multi-generational institutionalized phenomenon that has a very specific context, especially in this country, where we cannot avoid the legacy of that practice. And for me, to call this institution modern-day slavery, I've had this argument with other people. They're like, "Okay, we understand that it's not slavery. That's why we call it modern-day slavery." And I said, "Well, that's not really working for me entirely well. I understand that you're trying to tap into the 13th Amendment. You're trying to tap into the Nuremberg precedents. You're trying to basically create a legal precedence by which you can prosecute these cases. However, it's seems to me ahistorical in a way that is unhelpful. And also, when we talk of slavery, I again feel that it really deprives the people who are in this situation of the recognition that sometimes they have gone and tried to seek work and opportunity and then have been put in a situation of severe coercion or of forced labor. And slavery is like a state. I feel it as a kind of unchanging state, whereas I feel people move in and out of trafficking situations, and it doesn't get across some of those issues. Mm-hmm. So a lot of people I really I revere and have been very influential in my work refer to it as modern-day slavery, but for me, for reasons I'm still trying to articulate, I'm not fully comfortable with that.
Okay. So any questions?
I'm also, if you can, before you start to speak, because it's being recorded, if you could introduce yourself and also just state where you work at OSI, that would be helpful. Tom?
Sorry. Tom Kellogg, I work at OSI. like everybody else in the room. My question has to do with the IJM people and their desire to prove that there is a just and loving God through this type of work. And I wonder if you saw over time any evolution in at least some of their views. I've had the experience of talking to various sort of Christian movement people who work on China, and they come in sort of saying, if you say anything bad about any human rights activist in China, that means that you're a bad person. After talking to these guys 3 and 5 years later, they seem to see a bit more complexity. I wonder if you've seen a similar dynamic.
Absolutely, and that was the thing that was really interesting about the organization is they started out of a sense of emergency, which I think any of us would have if you read some of these stories, what happens to people. IJM is International Justice Mission, and they are an evangelical human rights group that does a lot of the interventions I was describing in areas where prostitution takes place. They also do a significant amount of work on other issues, like land grabbing and forced labor in India and a number of other issues that are actually very important, of course. And I did see an evolution in their tactics that I thought was really quite positive. They began to work with HIV providers to figure out ways to be less intrusive. They started to do more stings where you take the potential victim off site and then you do a kind of entrapment operation where you have the pimp try and sell you the services of that person and then you just bust them right there. Which is much less invasive than going into an entire establishment and arresting everyone there. And there was at least one death that did occur out of an IJM operation, a noodle seller who was rounded up and then denied her medication and died of a stroke in custody. She was not at all affiliated with the trafficking practice. I did see some very positive kind of evolutions in their work, and I commend them for that. There were still some things that I felt were problematic, however, which was a very persistent reluctance to engage with their critics and with sex worker organizations that actually, when you think about it, could become potentially very important allies in this struggle against trafficking, because there's a certain number of people who are in the sex industry whose entry into that work was marked by a trafficking situation.
Can you say more about why there is that persistent reluctance? I've been thinking for a long time in the China context that to tell you the truth, I generally ignore a lot of the Christian evangelical groups that work in China. If they called me, I would return their phone call. So I don't have a persistent reluctance to engage with them. They just do what they do, and we do what we do.
Right.
Do you see any chance that those barriers could be broken down? And why do you think that IJM has this persistent reluctance, as you put it?
I have great hopes I'm terribly optimistic. And so I really do hope that people of goodwill in law enforcement and human rights work can be able to kind of come together and look at not only the ideological or philosophical debates that they may have about each other's work, but see if there's some way to collaborate, to create law enforcement practices that are more holistic, less harm-inducing, and more considerate of the people, actors around them, and, to build some kind of trust and rapport. As for why that reluctance has been there, I think because the way IJM began their work was viewed as incredibly disruptive and disrespectful of the kind of work that was happening on the ground already. And it's like, why isn't an American NGO coming in here and doing undercover work and telling us how to deal with all of this? there was a very strong pushback and criticism, and that was also fostered by the context of sex workers groups being cut out of funding for counter-trafficking and then evangelical and feminist organizations. IJM has not said anything about prostitution. They've been very careful about that. But they were thrown in with that group and understood to be a Trojan horse, basically. You know, a group that comes in that says they work on counter-trafficking and actually are trying to eliminate all forms of prostitution. And so their reluctance also stems, however, out of a general desire by law enforcement to keep their operations quite small and not compromise their security. And so I understand that operational kind of mandate, but I do think there are ways to work around that. So, thanks.
I'm Abby Schwartz with the Southeast Asia Initiative. Thanks, Noy. That was really interesting. And the one question that I keep coming back to when I think about this issue myself, and I don't want to put you on the spot, but I wonder if in the course of your research you've come closer to coming up with a definition for yourself of the element of coercion. You said yourself, and you know, I think we all know this to be true, that part of the problem is that there's so few accurate figures because we're having so much trouble defining who is a victim of trafficking and who is a volitional sex worker or migrant laborer. Mm-hmm. And I think that it's pretty clear that the number of people that are actually, you know, like beaten over the head with a club, stuffed in a burlap sack, mm-hmm. and you know, taken across borders to work in a brothel are fewer than the numbers would indicate. On the other hand, I think that the number of people who reach the age of 18 and look around at their options and say, you know what, I think the best choice for me is to become a sex worker, is also maybe fewer than some people on the other side of the argument would argue. So I just wonder, have you come any closer to a definition?
I feel like there's several questions in there, actually. For me, it's been fairly clear with the people I interview. I basically ask them how they came to do what they're doing now. And so the fewer pointed questions I ask and the more like thick description they are allowed to have in telling their story, the more I can actually glean what the situation may have been like. And I guess it's a question that, you know, how many of us are actually doing what we really want to do? And to what degree is that shaped by economic necessity? And some people really feel that poverty is its push factor and poverty must be considered a form of coercion. And I'm like, well, I see what you're saying, but the way you're using that is specifically to talk about sex work, and you're never like, that poor garment factory worker, she's so poor, and that's what they don't really care that much about her. And so the underlying unspoken question is, how could anyone freely choose to do sex work? And that is the whole thing. We could talk about that forever in a day. But I think there's a range of choices that are available to people in any particular situation, but I ultimately came to believe this, which is that everyone I talked to was a rational actor and had an internal way of creating meaning in their lives. And if for them, sex work was a way to get immediate money. There's really no credit system in Cambodia. They didn't have enough money to pay the bribe to get a garment factory job, and frankly, they found a garment factory job really just yucky. They didn't want to do it. This was a way that enabled them to be with their families a bit more and to send money back in a steady way. And when I kind of understood it from their perspective and their point of view, then it became clear to me that this was a choice that they were making while considering all their possible options, which is why counter-trafficking work can never really be divorced from a larger conversation about economic development and other policies.
Maybe I can just ask a quick follow-up question to that, which also I think might also help clarify some of this around, which is that you talked about what's commonly referred to as end-demand legislation, which is basically a model of legislation which means that you include the making the solicitation or selling of sex illegal under trafficking framework, because then the theory is that you would end the demand for prostitutes or sex workers, so then you would end the demand to traffic people into a context that where they could then be a sex worker or a prostitute if they're trafficked into it. So, for instance, this is huge right now, as people who like soccer know, that the World Cup is coming up in South Africa. And, you know, all of the coverage about this has been around the fact that there's going to be a huge number of women that are trafficked in to South Africa to meet the demand. And so the South African government's response has been to consider whether they should be making sex work illegal under trafficking legislation. And so I guess my question to you then is, what evidence, is there evidence, or what is the discussion around, you know, trying to take the emotive side about away from that? And is there evidence to suggest that this end-demand tactic could have a positive impact on counter-trafficking scenarios?
I think the case study for that is Sweden. They enacted legislation which basically criminalized the procurement of services, but not the offering of services. So Johns, basically, and clients would get in trouble for doing what they want to do. And it's actually a point of great contention whether that will have any real impact on counter-trafficking or exploitative situations in prostitution. So I think one interesting way to think of it is we talk about ending demand, and that has always meant ending demand for prostitution. However, there are people who are talking about ending demand of goods that are created by forced labor, and that is a very, very interesting notion to me. So, for example, making sure that, like, again, the Coalition for a Coalition of Immokalee Workers and their campaign to ensure that food, you know, picked in the Florida fields is not picked by forced labor or by people who face incredibly, like, stringent and horrible labor conditions. So that's and kind of ending demand that I think is really worth thinking about just as much as the maybe difficult aspect of ending the demand for prostitution. So,
are there other questions for Nora?
I could just ask a quick question. This is Bipasha. I'm with OSI Fellowship. You talk about how women or other forced laborers people who are rescued from brothels or whatever, being given training that doesn't really help them.
Mm.
Have you come across models or training programs or anything that does give them alternatives that are positive, that will help them make choices? Give them choices, at least, about for economic activity that may not be garment work, but something that, or may not be makeup,
right,
but is something that can support their family. So there are successful models that you've come across.
Yeah, there are a few that I thought were really great, actually. I disagree with this particular person's tactics in general, but I thought she was doing some very interesting work on having trafficking victims enter into vocational programs that are already existent. And so they weren't like special programs, but these women would wind up being like aircraft repair people and doing all these really fascinating things that actually had a lot of economic viability. And there's a program in Cambodia by a faith-based organization called Hagar, and they're great. They have a very interesting shelter program, and they have businesses. So there was a catering business. So, for example, there's a training restaurant, and so the women could learn to make food and learn how to serve it. And then they'd be getting income while they're being trained, because a lot of the women I talked to were like, wow, that sounds great, but I'm not going to get any money when I'm going to get trained, and I can't feed my family if I do that. It's not just me, it's my family. So they were getting income as they were being trained, and they were kind of being trained in a very nurturing environment where they would have real practical, real-world experience, and then they could gradually develop their skills and then enter into the catering business and do all this other stuff. So I thought that was fantastic. Yeah, it was really good.
Hi, I'm Steve Hubble from the Fellowship Program. Noy, you mentioned that the journalistic project you've undertaken runs directly into the just how powerful the urge to protect and to punish is. And what kinds of journalistic strategies, as a reporter, but also as a bearer of a message that is unwelcome to many people, have proved successful for you? In other words, how do you counter the protect and punish impulse most effectively? I mean, what's worked for you?
Wow. I guess it's a kind of ever-growing process, and I guess the thing that I've been learning is to totally shut up. and really, if I'm going to ask someone questions about this kind of experience, I'm not going to ask questions. I'm going to ask one or two questions in the beginning, and they will talk, and I will listen the whole time. And if I have another question, I'm going to make a note in the margin, and then I will go back and ask them again. And basically, it's like for me to really put the primacy of that person's experience to the very forefront of what I'm trying to do. And to recognize and try and depict the ways in which people are whole people. And that includes not only the people who are survivors of trafficking, but also the people who try to help them with whom I have disagreements. And so that was actually what I said to you, Abby, about people being rational actors and they all have their own internal mechanism by which they generate meaning in their lives. I spent a lot of time going to church when I was working on this piece because I really wanted to understand what was happening. And it was incredibly useful for me because I began to understand the ways in which the crime of trafficking was an affront to what they believed was the dignity of a person made in the image of God and the role that sexuality had to play in that. And so I guess the way to try and get out of that is to try and depict everyone in this conversation as a whole and conflicted and complicated character, because they all are. And just trying to keep it all in my head at the same time and not go over my word count. So
I guess I was just going to ask one last question, which is on that note. I mean, you have a really complicated message to send in a way. And so and part of the beauty of the of kind of the message that the Bush administration and other counter-trafficking efforts has sent is, you know, trafficking is slavery and this has to stop, and if it in any way possible. And so, you know, how are you going to, what's, I guess, you know, along that note, what do you see as kind of some of the bigger challenges in trying to communicate a very complicated message and also without, frankly, a lot of research to support that message? Right. Because, you know, I mean, I think from both sides, there's no credible research. Mm-hmm. And so, and for an understandable reason, it's a very hard it's a very hard problem to document credibly, if it's at all possible even to do that. Right. And so I guess, you know, how are some, I think along the same lines that Steve is asking, but I mean, do you think it's going to be possible to kind of craft a message that's going to be easily digestible to a general public on this issue of sex work, trafficking, prostitution, slavery?
Right. It's definitely a challenge because there's a reason why this is so, it just gets right into all of the stuff that we have about force and sex and bodies and the horror of it is just really pushes people in an incredibly emotive way. And I would say if we're horrified at what has happened to people, then it behooves us to listen to what they might want. And it's, I think, everything about the work that we do here at OSI is about actually really listening and amplifying the voices of people who have been in those situations and who, why haven't people been able to actually help draft and create the policies that are supposed to affect their lives? Isn't that what this whole thing is about? And so I guess I would call for a certain humility on the part of policymakers in foregrounding the experiences of people who face the situation. And and I guess I would call on people to question the narratives that they hold dear and ask why they are so significant to them personally. And is it possible to understand that narrative that they have and they hold so dear when they hear the narrative of another person?
Okay, I'm Lee Hollingby from the library. So I recently read Half the Sky by Nicholas Kristof and Cheryl Wudunn, which people might be familiar with, about the oppression of women, and the subtitle is something like Turning Oppression into Opportunity, but there's an awful lot more oppression, unfortunately, in the book than there is opportunity. But anyway, they do try to put a positive spin and say that it is possible to help people. But I guess they begin in the introduction by saying that they really hope that these issues, whether you call it sexual slavery, forced prostitution, forced labor, trafficking in women will become the issue of the 21st century, the way slavery, the way we think of it, became the issue of the 19th century, and maybe battling totalitarianism became the issue of the 20th century. Personally, I don't see any hope right now for this issue becoming the big issue of the 21st century. I mean, I think if you look at what's on the front burner, it's climate change, terrorism, I don't know, healthcare reform, debt, you know, economic depression. But I just wondered if you saw any hope of this issue really rising in the national and international consciousness to a much higher level, the way slavery actually did in the 19th century.
Wow. It's interesting. People who talk about trafficking also link it to a lot of the issues that you're talking about. So, for example, people who work in trafficking are beginning to try and address how climate change may affect migration and abusive labor policies. So if there's a drought, what do people do? They leave. And sometimes they leave under coercive situations. And sometimes if immigration policy and work policy is not adequately open, then they will find themselves in very coercive situations. So there's ways to talk about trafficking and how it links to a lot of the issues that you've presented. I would argue that for trafficking to really be understood as the problem it is, we have to widen our understanding of it, because it is frankly, people would rather talk about prostitution than talk about the abuse of domestic workers in their homes. They would rather talk about prostitution than agricultural labor. That, I mean, I eat tomatoes every day. I mean, no one wants to talk about the ways in which this has become enmeshed in the fabric of our everyday lives, but it is something that is part of how we understand work and labor situations if we take a social justice approach to it. So I think there's been a myopia and a sensationalism around the issue of trafficking that has really actually done a lot of people an injustice. There are so many male victims of trafficking, and they're not offered the same services that a lot of people who work, women and children in prostitution are, for example. But that's an issue that affects them as much as as the women and children do. So.
Thank you very much, Noy. And we all look forward to seeing the articles that come out of your fellowship. And there will likely be other events throughout the year around this issue. And so thank you very much for coming. And thanks again, Noy.
Thank you.